it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sunny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spiffy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Many thanks, as always, to the folks who are listening on Tuesday. If you're not a subscriber, you missed out on a hot bonus episode last week on Lindy West and the death of millennial feminism. You're definitely not going to want to miss our Harry Potter episode this week. The new trailer's out. And it's got no color. And it's exactly the same as the movies. And the 2019 rump pop culture writers who are like, ah, you can't do this ethically, they're still mad about things. And they're boycotting it. And it's still going to be the most watched show on HBO in the history of HBO, probably. This thing's going to be enormous. We'll discuss why. And now on to controversies and non-controversies. I remember a few months back, Disney decided to allow Sora to use a bunch of Disney characters, and Disney invested $1 billion in OpenAI. Well, a little update on that. None of it is happening anymore. None of it. That's because Sora is shutting down altogether. OpenAI moving its processor power into the more straightforwardly business-minded avenues of like vibe coding, I guess, and solving other problems for businesses. You know, businesses pay for these things. It's not just you know, people using all the GPUs to make videos of Darth Vader dancing with Peter Griffin. Apparently that's not a valuable business model. Who knew? Who could have guessed? The timing here is interesting, though, because OpenAI and Disney had, again, just 3 months ago, signed this big deal to legally allow the use of Disney characters in OpenAI slop. The deal also came with $1 billion investment in OpenAI, which, again, Disney is no longer on the hook for. Disney, for their part, has said that they are still willing to license their characters to other AI people. So I don't know. It's a weird kind of ignominious end to a project that was touted as a Hollywood killer. People were freaking out. And there are still plenty of image producing AIs out there. Some of them not based in the United States and like doing things pretty straightforwardly infringing. It's also clear, though, that the combination of a fear of lawsuits and a lack of real commercial use for these things has, I think, made AI video a dicey proposition, at least in the sense of how people were using it on social media. The lawsuit threats are, I think, at least part of the key here, right? There's a tag at the end of the New York Times story about Sora and Disney stating that the Times is suing OpenAI for stealing all of its content. A North Carolina man pled guilty this month to using AI to create music and then using bots to automatically stream said music, right? And then he got royalties in the amount of $8 million, by the way. It's good business. That's a great scam, actually. I'm gonna test that one out.
It's a great business until you go to jail.
The feds start paying attention to something else. I'm just going to be like, hey, I got some AI music and some AI bots over here. Anyway, recently, the horror novel Shy Girl was canceled by its publishers after readers suggested that it was the product of AI writing, which the author denied. They said, no, it was a fact checker. I'm just as outraged as everybody else. Sure. Peter, as everyone knows, you are our resident AI fanatic. You're a fanatic about AI. You love it. You love it so much. It's your favorite thing in the whole world. What does all this mean? There's a lot kind of floating in the air right now about AI and all that. What does this all mean if you are in the content creation business? You know, artists, the newfangled term for artists.
Not a fanatic, just a fan, you know? Just a fan out there writing slash fiction about OpenAI and Anthropic getting together, you know? Hot and heavy fan fiction, right? That's what it's about. If I understand.
No.
It's going to be the next big HBO.
Stop.
It's going to be. I don't know where I'm going with this. Look, this is just not that big a deal. It's really not that big a deal. $1 billion in the context of OpenAI's valuation, much less in the context of OpenAI plus Anthropic, right? All the big companies, you know, and even Grok, which, yes, is sort of clearly the third place trailer here, is nothing. Disney still says they want to license this material to other companies. There are other companies in the United States that are going to produce AI video. Sora was not the bleeding edge. The bleeding edge for Hollywood style video is the Chinese company Seed Dance, which one of the reasons why their model seems to be better is that they've completely ignored AI US copyright law. We can argue about whether that's good or whether it's bad or whether it's both. Right, sort of a secondary discussion there, but like they just weren't able to beat the Chinese competition in this respect. So it's not that surprising. Also, Anthropic is clearly leading the way in terms of business development for AI, and it seems pretty clear that OpenAI is looking to sort of go in that direction and say, look, we're gonna put our money and our time and our effort into stuff that has an obvious business use case. And Mimi Disney videos, that's not obviously a huge business. At the same time, like what you said, Sonny, was, I forget exactly what your line was, but like the AI videos that you see on Twitter, right? This shows that that's not the future of this stuff. That's kind of always been true to some degree or another. Creating memeable, shareable social media videos has never been like, oh, that's going to be the killer thing that AI gets used for, or AI video gets used for, or any of this. The killer thing is going to be something else. And there's a bunch of possibilities there. One of which is something much more like what Ben Affleck developed and sold to Netflix. And if you've read the coverage there, he developed an AI company that he sold for, I think the top end is something like $600 million. And that's if it performs the way they want it to. It's a lot of money. It's not billions, but it's a lot of money. And what Ben Affleck is saying, what Netflix is saying about the technology that they have there is, this is going to allow us to fix and edit movies much more quickly. We're not going to create movies from scratch. What we're going to do is we're going to take, say, a draft or we're going to take a scene and we're going to be able to rebuild it using AI tools. He's promising, you know, that they're not going to violate, you know, the contracts that people have, you know, for face use, right? That sort of, or for likeness use, that sort of thing, right? Instead, this is just going to be the thing that we have already seen done using computer effects for decades. There was that, if you guys remember, the Taika Waititi profile in the New York Times Magazine, I believe it was, from around when he was working on one of the Thor movies. And, you know, he's not like, he didn't come up as an effects director, but he was working on a Marvel movie and he was just like directing a scene, and they described him cutting a scene down from quite a few minutes. I don't remember, 6-8 minutes. And the goal was to get it down to like 2 or 3 minutes. And he was like, you know, this would be much better if we just had this character over here. And they didn't have the shot. The shot didn't exist. They were like, and the effects guy, the editor, was just like, don't worry about it. We will just create that out of the material we have. That sort of thing has already been done in effects work for years. And this is what AI is going to be used for in Hollywood, is to automate those processes so that instead of taking hours, they're going to take minutes. It's just going to be, you just type something into, right? The director basically just says, I want this. And instead of a couple of guys spending a couple of days on it, it just kind of happens in the background. And so this just doesn't strike me as that big a deal or that meaningful. It does tell you the direction that AI, that the big AI companies are going, is towards clear business use cases that are monetizable. This is becoming something more like a normal business.
Yeah, Alyssa, that does seem to be the real thrust here, which is that, like, again, if you're a competent business, the thing you do is you look at expenses, and making AI video very expensive. Like, that's the thing about these they use huge numbers of, you know, processors, a huge amount of compute, as they put it, to make things that are like not valuable, that are just objectively not valuable. And now they're gonna redirect that finite amount of compute power that they have to something else. Which, and again, the other thing here is, I do think that there's some, the world of lawsuits and the legal threats that they're kind of existing under definitely you know, I think give them some pause. But at the same time, like, it just it's really interesting because I, you know, everybody was like, oh, this is the Hollywood killer. This is it. This is where, you know, no more jobs and everybody's going to be computers. And now it's mostly the AI companies look at the entertainment industry like this is a waste of all of our time.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that are interesting about this story that neither of you have brought up yet. I think it's most interesting to, and sort of most consequential, to discuss this story in the context of OpenAI's desire to sort of rush into the space vacated by Anthropic sort of expulsion from the Department of War, right? There has been this, you know, part of the challenge for the Department of War in the showdown with Anthropic is that Anthropic was the big AI company that was cleared to handle sort of confidential material, that had, you know, sort of clearance to handle this stuff safely. And OpenAI has clearly been sort of burning cash, obviously, has been very anxious about Anthropic's sort of rise as a viable business. And Anthropic doesn't have a video generation tool. Google has one, Nano Banana, which is embedded in Gemini. My daughter and I actually use it a fair amount to like make stuff for clubs at school and things. And
there's a bunch of other companies working in that space, in some cases using using the base models developed by either OpenAI or some other
companies. But so OpenAI, you know, sort of swooped in and was like, you know, we'll do stuff for the Department of Defense. We'll find ways to sort of avoid the ethical dilemmas that Anthropic thought it was running into. But they're very far behind on developing tools like Claude Code that have sort of immediate, you know, that have been widely adopted, whose uses have been identified, who, you know, are developing sort of real clear businesses. And so, you know, again, as Peter said, this is much more sort of a move towards these being more normal businesses. But I think in a way, Disney's desire to keep licensing its characters really suggests to me that the company has kind of not learned a lot of lessons over the past couple of years. Because it seems to me that licensing your characters to AI, even with ostensible sort of gatekeeping, is just a massive reputational risk, right? And it's not just because of, you know, what Bo Burnham described as like, you know, the bunch of fanfic drawings of all the Harry Potter characters fucking each other, right? It is, you know, it seems so, which many...
No, it's the OpenAI and Anthropic bots who are getting it on in cyber. They're cybering.
Oh my God, Peter, this is like, I feel like this is, if you keep talking about this, I'm going to like throw myself into the sea. It's awful. Just stop it. but if you are Disney and you've just been through just like tons of disastrous political mishigas, why on earth would you make it easier for someone to steal stuff from a trailer you've released, suggest that there is, you know, sexual content or transgender characters or whatever gets people angry on the internet on any given week in an upcoming Disney release, have it go viral, and then tank the movie, right?
This is like a great argument, and I want to argue against you. Like, go. I want to hear the end of this, but I actually want to argue against you using something that I think, well, I think you'll understand.
I think there are just, like, the fact that I think you're absolutely right that making various parts of the filmmaking process more efficient totally makes sense as a business use for AI, right? And as a business use for AI, and also specifically for the film industry in the state that it is in right now. But making it easier for people to alter your content and pose reputational risks to your IP feels insane to me. It just feels bananas. It really struck the Disney Sora deal really struck me as a company. It struck me as the actions of a company that was actually not thinking really seriously about this technology and the ways to use it to bring down costs, to make work more efficient, and that was just still high on the, like, image generation is cool. People are going to want to play with this move. And I think, like, look, I think if you're OpenAI, there's also something good about shutting down your video generation business in the middle of a really combustible military situation in the Middle East, right? I mean, you know, social media companies have really avoided kind of material consequences for the extent to which they've made it easy for terrible things to happen geopolitically around the world. But I would really, like, I would be pretty anxious about being in the image generation business right now as sort of a form of geopolitical risk. And, you know, I think this was the business that got everyone thinking about AI, right? Like, it's cool to, you know, it's cool that it can render these images. It's cool that it can do this. It's, like, fun to make Darth Vader dance the Macarena. But it could get a lot less fun really quickly, whether from a business perspective or a geopolitical one. And obviously, pulling Sora is not going to prevent that from happening, right? I mean, Seed Dance exists. Companies will keep doing this because it looks cool. But I think there are just a lot of downsides to that particular application of AI. And I think we're seeing a lot of them swirling around together at once.
So I think it's obviously the case that current AI image generation, video generation tools don't do what filmmakers need them to do. They don't generate clips that are long enough. They also don't, even if you can generate, even if you're only working with short clips, generating short clips that maintain visual consistency, whether it's the look of a character or just the general vibe, still, that is a problem that hasn't been solved yet. It's not obvious how much that solving that problem is worth. It seems like OpenAI didn't want to devote themselves to solving that problem. There are rumors that the next generation of Seed Dance, again, separate issue about how they're getting there, but there are rumors that the next generation of Seed Dance solves a lot of those problems with 10 to 15 minute clips and pretty good memory, right? It's able to sort of remember character descriptions, remember sets, remember, right, and sort of move around in a consistent world. But the question you asked was why Disney would want to be involved in this. And I think I can answer that in one word, and that is troops. The 1997 Cops parody, featuring stormtroopers. Because if you recall, and I know you know this in some ways better than I do, Alyssa, is that before Disney acquired Lucasfilm, Lucas had a policy that you could create anything you wanted, any kind of fan fiction, whether it was video, whether it was a story, whether it was an image, so long as you didn't profit off of it. It was essentially a kind of bespoke Creative Commons license for Star Wars. And this helped grow the fan community, especially in that period of time between the end of the original trilogy and the Phantom Menace. This was a big part of what kept it alive. Yes, there were also the novels and a bunch of other stuff, but part of what was going on there was fans were making their own Star Wars. What I think Disney was going for and what I think Disney was trying to do and what I think there is actually a clear business case for that you can see in Star Wars is that if you allow fans to create their own thing, to use this as a toy box, especially if you're not violating any of the contracts, you know, right? The way this deal worked, you couldn't use Han Solo. You couldn't use, because that's Harrison Ford's likeness. You couldn't use, Princess Leia because it's Carrie Fisher's likeness. But you had lightsabers. You had sort of all of the animated characters that are not owned by someone because it's their face, yeah, that sort of thing. And this was going to allow them to create, to go back to our joke, this was going to allow them to create modern fan fiction using AI. And what we have seen is that as much as Sunny doesn't like it, and as much as there are, in fact, weird, bad, and sort of awful things about certain types of fan fiction can keep fandom alive, and that can be good for the business. And yeah, I think that's what Disney was going for here.
Maybe, but at the same time, they're just huge different, like, you know, things published in like courier fonts on, you know, text-based websites were just never going to be indistinguishable from, you know, Empire Strikes Back, right? The gulf between the two things was too high. They were never going to, you could never mistake one for the other. And I think the reputational risk with video is much higher in the sense that you can create a brief image or a clip that is, to someone scrolling on clips on Instagram, is not distinguishable from Star Wars, and you can use that to whip up panics, campaigns, political nonsense really easily. And I think, can I just say, finish one thought? I promise. Yeah. I think that we're seeing something very interesting right now in the convergence of sort of fan fiction and the general publishing industry, right? I mean, you have all of these things that are starting out as sort of self-published works that publishers want to be able to pick and choose from. But again, they want to be able to pick and choose what they elevate from, you know, fan writing or sort of internet-based self-published stuff, and to give the sort of, you know, fancy book cover, you know, design and marbling process to, they want to be able to have some level of discernment. And I think for movies, video just makes that much harder.
And yet the origins of fan fiction are not maybe entirely, but heavily rooted in stories about how Kirk and Spock were actually gay, right? Or they're rooted in the 1970s, right? In a world in which that was much more politically outre, right? Like, it was just that, like, gay rights as we know it did not, I mean, yes, they were starting, right? And Starfleet was based in San Francisco, but like gay rights as we know them now did not exist in the 1970s when that stuff was happening.
The point is not whether the fan fiction is outre. The question is whether the fan fiction is indistinguishable from the real thing. And the way that I just think it's sort of two separate problems.
I think part of I'm less concerned about that just because Sora in its existing form was not going to produce anything that anybody was going to be able to would think was the actual movie.
Okay. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that OpenAI killed Sora and its video creation team? Peter.
I actually think it's a controversy. Google has especially in the first 15 years or so of its sort of rise to dominance, just constantly started up product lines and then killed them. Do you remember Wave? Do you remember Google Reader? Even things that people loved, they would just sort of build and then forget to pay attention to and then cancel. That's what tech companies do.
I've mentioned this before, but my big theory of the hinge moment of American society is Google killing Google Reader, which forced all of the journalists to go to Twitter to promote their work, which in turn led to the rise of Twitter, which has led to many bad things. Alyssa, controversy or controversy?
Controversy.
I also think it's a controversy. I don't know. I find it hard to care that much, especially when it seems like the obvious truth here is that, like, OpenAI is just like, this didn't make us any money. There's no money here in this. So we're going to do things that make money, which frankly is probably the best solution for everybody. Hopefully they get into the missile aiming business. There's probably more money in that. All right. Make sure to swing by Thursday for our bonus episode on Harry Potter. Harry Potter's back, this time in TV form. And now on to the main event.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The Housemaid. All right, so we did not do The Housemaid when it came out, because it came out in the midst of the Oscar season, right? We had a ton of other movies to review. But the film, which again came out the week before Christmas, slowly racked up box office bucks. I think it opened at $19 million and wound up with about $160 million domestic, something like that, $140, $150, $60, somewhere in there. But it worldwide box office gross almost $400 million. It silenced some of the whispers that had started up about Sydney Sweeney's status as a star. You know, she had been in some indie misfires, and then she comes out with this one, is like, no, actually, if you put me in the sexy lady movie, I can actually get people to show up. But we can talk about that too in a second, because I find this all very, the marketing of this movie very interesting. Anyway, it's on VOD now. It's hitting stars in a few days. If you have stars, if you're one of the 17 people in the country who has stars with a Z, it's going to be on stars. There's not really anything else in theaters this week, opening up this week. Nobody wanted to put any big projects in between Project Hail Mary and Super Mario Galaxy, it seems. So we thought we would loop back to this one and try to figure out why precisely it hits such a sweet spot with viewers, particularly with female viewers. As it happens, we have a female here on the show, Alyssa. we're gonna get your opinion on this. But we got some spoilers coming, so log off now if you have not seen The Housemaid, which came out 4 months ago, three and a half months ago. If you have not seen it and you're worried about spoilers, log off. We're gonna be talking about it. All right. The first thing worth mentioning is, as I mentioned, the advertising campaign for this was a little bit weird, and there was a bit of misdirection going on. I saw the trailer for this about 1,000 times in theaters before it came out. I saw this trailer like 4 times a week. It was playing in front of everything. And every time I saw the trailer, I thought in my head, okay, so it's kind of like Single White Female or Fatal Attraction or something, right? You've got Sydney Sweeney, who is playing the interloper hired on as the housemaid who inserts herself into Amanda Seyfried's marriage to some random hot guy. I didn't even bother looking his name up as I was writing this. And I'm not even going to bother with character names. I'm just going with Sydney Sweeney and Amanda Seyfried. And that is kind of right. That is kind of how the movie starts off, kind of, right? In the opening moments, Sweeney, who is living in her car, is hired to serve as the housemaid for the Winchesters. Seyfried is at first kind of frazzled and then like clearly very crazy. She's on antipsychotic meds. She's making up reasons to yell at Sydney Sweeney. She's threatening to fire her. And this would be a big problem. Getting fired would be a big problem for Sweeney's character, given that she is on probation, a fact that she has not mentioned anybody in the hiring process. Sweeney does, in fact, insinuate herself into the marriage, sleeping with hot husband. Their affair leads to him demanding a divorce. Seyfried is out. Except, oops, hot husband is actually the crazy one here. He locks Sweeney in the attic. And we shift perspectives at this point to Seyfried. Yada, yada, yada. Turns out he was gaslighting her and all of the neighbors this whole time. And now it's time for Sweeney, already convicted of murdering one man who was abusing a woman, to take revenge. The comp here, again, is not Fatal Attraction, actually, as it turns out. It's actually Gone Girl. This movie is structurally identical to Gone Girl. But it's like kind of an ideologically slash gender reversed version of Gone Girl. Because whereas Gone Girl is basically a cinematic manifestation of like the manosphere's worst fears about women. Like, here's this crazy broad who's going to pretend to be raped and ruin everybody's life. She's going to pretend to kill herself. So you get the death penalty and you're scorned by the entire universe. This is a cinematic manifestation of this movie that we're talking about today, The Housemaid, is a cinematic manifestation of the fear of what happens when you don't believe women, when you write them off as crazy because their husbands are so charming. And once you realize that, it becomes incredibly obvious, I think, why the film has struck a chord with female audiences, which made up about 70% of the movie's opening weekend. A number I remember, I'm off script here for a second. I was surprised by that number because I thought to myself, it's not clear to me that Sydney Sweeney is going to appeal to the female audiences unless she is like the bad guy who's trying to insert herself into the relationship. But my understanding is that's not what's going on. Anyway, this is a movie about sisters coming together to fight the patriarchy. Doesn't matter that the movie is not very good, and it's not good. It has very basic structural problems that we might get into in a minute, particularly involving the shift in the voiceover. Like, Amanda Seyfried's delivering this voiceover and she's like, I'm writing you this letter, daughter. And if you are reading it, it means you're either 18 or I'm dead. And then instead of delivering the letter, she just goes and picks her up at the museum and they leave. What's happening? Anyway, it doesn't matter. All that matters is that it delivers to the goods to an audience that always shows up when you give them the goods. This audience is turning Colleen Hoover into a cinematic franchise all on her own. You know, you got Where the Crawdads Sing. It's a huge hit. You got Wuthering Heights. So you got sexy Wuthering Heights making $250 million worldwide. Alyssa, once again, you are a lady. What did you make of The Housemaid? You're the target audience here. What did you make of The Housemaid?
It's quite enjoyable trash. And I feel like there's a noble tradition of trash in women's fiction that is sort of misunderstood and underanalyzed and under-theorized. And actually, one of the people who wrote about it best was Nora Ephron in the book reviews that she wrote for the New York Times. She reviewed like Jacqueline Suzanne's The Love Machine, you know, Rana Jaffe's The Best of Everything. And she really was able to sort of identify the combination of morality tale and transgression that makes up pleasurable trash, right? Like she wrote about The Valley of the Dolls, which was Suzanne's first big just smash hit novel, which is about a bunch of young women who move to LA and, you know, to become actresses and end up, you know, addicted to pills and crazy. And I don't remember if any of them end up murdered, but it's entirely possible. And she points out that the sort of women's trash does something very effective, which is that it lets you enjoy the thought of having an adventure and then feel very good about not having had it, right? And so in this case, Sydney Sweeney, like gets to get naked with, you know, her employer's husband, but then like makes it up to her, right? It's like she gets punished. Yes. Like she has to carve a bunch of gnarly cuts in her stomach, but she makes it up to her erstwhile employer by like helping murder her awful husband and cover it up. And so, you know, this movie is a morality tale, right? And that it's like it is not a good idea to get swept up by the, you know, by the illusion of like wealth and caring for a guy that you don't know very well. But and it's like actually like your husband, boyfriend, cat, whatever, like really is a superior substitute, and you were smart enough not to fall for this nonsense in the first place. And so this is trash, right? It is, you know, to the extent that it is sort of a sisterhood of revenge flick, and the a sequel to this is absolutely like it's already in the works. There's a whole series here. It is, you know, it is part
she's
of.
She's just gonna go around murdering husbands all around the country.
Yes, literally. That's literally
like what they
the
set
setup
up at the end of this. Yeah, at the end of this movie, it's like. We're gonna have you heard about the Avenging Wives initiative? Like it's like
yes,
it's like
100%.
What is happening here?
It's like the first wives club except trashier. And you know, I do think this is in some ways a throwback. You know, there's some sort of throwback Avenging Angel Me Too stuff about this, but it is just part of a much longer tradition of trash, aimed at women. You know, and it's an indulgence, right? Peter described it in our text chain as like the McGriddle of movies. And like, that's exactly what it is, right? It is a McFlurry of a movie. It is insubstantial. You will probably feel slightly bad like an hour after eating it. But at the same time, it cost you what, like $3 and provided a sense of like sort of momentary pleasure. And there's just like, you know, guys watch like Liam Neeson save various daughters or like be an old tough dude. And like women like sexy, soapy, dumb morality tales, right? Like, I mean,
yeah,
this is my gender essentialism, right? That like guys like the male version of trash is one in which like nobody has any feelings and like lots of people have a gun. And the female version of trash is like everybody has so many feelings and there's so much morality, right? And like also some sex that you get to enjoy because it's wrapped up in a morality tale.
And a beautiful house.
Gorgeous house.
This is, yeah, it's this like, is in fact,
it's very Nancy Myers.
Yes. Very Nancy Myers, right? Set design here is exquisite. And I don't just mean that it's beautiful. It is perfectly tailored to suit the mood, the tone. I mean,
this is a movie that has a substantial subplot involving someone's awful, tasteless heirloom china, by the way. Just, it's wretched. Sorry.
His mom brought that from London.
It's hideous. His mom is trashy.
But every single
what is gonna do, lock
object
me in an attic?
Inside
his mom doesn't make any sense. Is there nothing? His mom, your teeth are a privilege, not a right. What does that even mean? That's a nonsense.
We're supposed to understand that his psychopathy was passed down from
mother. I get it.
In the same way,
basically, it just doesn't make any sense.
Which is a trash trope, right? I mean. And the thing is, like,
but it's the same thing as in Frankenstein when Frankenstein gets it from his mean dad.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, sort of an underrated aspect of female oriented trash is that it's often like sadistic or just plain fucked up in some way. Right. I mean, the fact that Flowers in the Attic is like became like a whole franchise of like mass market paperbacks. It's like a crazed multi-generational incest saga. Like, women like weird nonsense is what I'm saying. But well-executed trash is hard to pull off. And, like, this is not, there are definitely potholes in this, but, like, Amanda Seyfried and Sydney Sweeney just, like, understood the assignment in this and are delightful. Lots of problems around them, but, like, they are great. I would watch 5 of these movies if I had time.
We might end up watching 5 of these.
This can be my thing, where I'm like, we will review every piece of the Housemaid franchise, just like Peter makes us review all the Marvel stuff.
And hand-me-down Joel Edgerton is not bad as the bad husband.
No, he's more a combination of Josh Hartnett and what's his name from The Strangers?
He gave much Joel Edgerton. You can just see Joel Edgerton playing this.
It's like Garrett. It's like whoever the guy is who plays Gale in the Hunger Games. Who is
Scott
that?
Speedman.
What did you?
He's knockoff. He's jacked Scott Speedman is what he is.
Alyssa, I'm curious.
Do you guys just want to ask me what I think of the sex scenes? Is that what asking me about?
No, I was going to ask you about the fact that this is directed, first of all, by the guy by Paul Feig, who made Spy and Bridesmaids. So just sort of, in some ways, this fits within his oeuvre, right? He made Lady Ghostbusters, right? This is a guy who has made female-fronted films for female audiences for most of his career. But it's also, this is a genre that sort of, like the novel was written by a woman. This is obviously targeted at women, but the director is a man.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really have an issue with that. I think Paul Feig is interested in what women enjoy and think about. And has made a number of pretty... I mean, he also did A Simple Favor, right? He directed or at least produced A Simple Favor.
He directed it and the sequel.
Yeah. And look, I think that... I love a lot of work by female directors. I also think female directors are capable of producing completely just bonker stuff. And I appreciate that there is a man who is willing to work in the genres of melodrama. I mean, I think Spy is unbelievably funny. That is one of my just sort of throw on when I'm in a weird mood. Like, the combination of Melissa McCarthy and Jason Statham is amazing, as is Jason Statham insisting that, like, he should just go into a face-off machine and being very angry that a face-off machine doesn't exist. I appreciate feeling sort of globally listened to and catered to by Paul Feig, right? Like, I think he's very much an anomaly in the entertainment industry, but he's also just sort of a throwback to, like, the screwball directors, the directors of women's pictures, you know? There is kind of a tradition there that has been absent for a long time. But I also appreciate that he's willing to make a career that's, like, you know, not too serious, not too self-serious. I appreciate you, Paul Feig, if you're listening to this podcast. Thank you.
He's done well. This is his, I believe, his biggest movie ever.
It's right up there. Well, domestically, I'm not sure. Actually, Bridesmaids and The Heat were both
total.
Very big hits.
Just domestically, but like, and this was made on a $35 million budget, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, one great
movie,
set.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's just the house.
Yeah, this is definitely his biggest movie in terms of box office. He's had kind of a weird career. Like, I was looking at his IMDb page before this.
Freaks and Geeks, man, to this.
Yeah, but like also like since A Simple Favor, which was like which did very well. He made a movie called Last Christmas, The School for Good and Evil, and Jackpot, which I've seen none of those. I have not only never seen any of those. I had not. I don't think heard of at least two of them. And then another.
Well, he was a comedy director, and he needed to work.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Anyway, it's interesting. This is kind of a departure. Anyway, Peter, what did you make of this movie? We haven't really gotten your take on this film yet. We've been dancing around it. I'm afraid what you're going to say here. Don't get us canceled with your masculine. Your
overly
masculine
takes. I basically
agree
with Alyssa. I mean, this isn't targeted at me, but I think this is pretty effective trash. It's not high grade. It's very much Gone Girl. It's also, you know, The Girl on the Train, which was pretty straightforwardly a Gone Girl ripoff. It's in that zone. There's the other one written by the guy. The girl in the window. Yeah, the woman in the window,
where the guy himself turned out to be some sort of insane fabulist. That New Yorker profile is great.
Did we do that for the show? I feel like that
we
was
did.
A
it was a
COVID
Netflix
era
movie,
show.
If I recall. It was
with Amy Adams, and it was with Amy Adams. It was awful.
Yes, terrible movie.
And this just follows the same formula. The monologue is designed to feel like the mid movie monologue in Gone Girl, right? Yeah. This one comes at the 3/4 mark rather than halfway through, but it's about the same way. You know, sort of pretty similar in tone. And I thought this was going to be much soapier, much more of a kind of reality TV sort of like trash. This felt like a movie. And I mean that in a good way. And I don't mean it felt like a good movie exactly, but it felt like an actual movie. And while, yes, it's obviously very indebted to Gone Girl, I do think it is indebted as well to those single white female sort of female targeted, female, you know, sort of domestic thrillers that we grew up with in the late 80s and 1990s, because they were all of those movies were in some sense about the preservation of domestic life. And this movie has a somewhat sort of modern twist on that idea, but it is essentially the same thing about sort of what is the domestic world and like how could it, right? And then like what is the domestic fantasy? And then how does that domestic fantasy go wrong? And then how does that fantasy going wrong right itself, often through revenge, murder, craziness, whatever. And this is a very competent version of that. And it's interesting, you know, that you both talked about Sydney Sweeney as a, well, you know, it's not clear that people thought of her as like a lust object for men, basically. And in fact, she's very good at playing the stand-in for women. And look, that makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways, right? Like, for male actors that like,
where are you going with this,
male
Peter?
Actors are guys that guys want to be. And like male leads in many cases, right? Like men want, and also women are like, they're dreamy. And she possesses both of those qualities. I don't think she's a great actress. I do think she is a pretty effective screen presence. And what she manages to do is be someone that, yes, guys find quite attractive, but also women can imagine, especially the way she plays it here. She allows herself to become a kind of vehicle for female fantasy. They can imagine being her, being a little bit down on their luck, being sort of taken by this world, right? This seemingly perfect domestic world that as soon as you get into it, you find is deeply broken and screwed up in a bunch of ways. And then what do you ultimately come out of it with? Well, you had some great sex and also you made a good gal friend.
The movie also does something in this vein. The movie does something very smart with her character, which again is the way I had kind of imagined this movie playing out from the trailers was Sydney Sweeney comes in and steals the husband, and then she goes crazy and they have to get rid of her. But that's not how it plays in the movie. The way it plays in the movie is it sets her up incredibly sympathetically. She's living in her car. She, you know, she moves in with this family, but she is immediately confronted with an insane person who is like behaving insanely in a way that makes her very obviously sympathetic from the get-go. Like, it's like she's being abused on there's something weird is happening here. She's clearly the victim, et cetera.
She is undergoing an ordeal that is being sort of perpetrated by a female peer. I mean, there's a weird way in which this is basically just the plot of Ender's Game, right? It's like you go and like all of the other kids are mean and terrible to you, right? And you've got to get through it and like figure out how to be the leader in your world. And
but
she doesn't
also
kill Bozo in this case, but same idea.
Yeah, but it's also a movie about, it's very much a movie about class, right? And the idea of sort of escaping into a secure class position, right? And one thing I was going to say, and I think one reason I actually feel weirdly grateful for this movie, it is the only mainstream Hollywood movie I've ever seen that addresses the challenges of being a nursing mother at work. Like Amanda Seyfried's character specifically like falls for, you know, horrible hot husband when he is like kind to her in a situation where other people humiliate her for like leaking breast milk at work. The movie actually shows her pumping. But yes, it's very much a movie about sort of escaping into this kind of class fantasy and then finding it that it is a nightmare. And interestingly enough, like Love Story with the Ryan Murphy miniseries about sort of Carolyn Bessette and John F. Kennedy Jr., I think strikes some of these same chords. And it has been very interesting to see that movie kind of that miniseries, you know, provoke this sort of craze for Carolyn Bessette Kennedy's style. And I think there is some, there's sort of a fantasy about having the money and the security and the sort of elan and calm without having to have the guy. And, you know, and we're still, we're missing sort of a third example to make this a trend. But the idea of sort of old money or American upper class, specifically of a kind of like chilly New England variety being a horror story, there's something in the air right now. It's interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. The movie is, you guys are both giving this a real pass because it is a theatrical Hallmark film. Like this is a, not Lifetime, Lifetime movie. This is a Lifetime movie. It is, I would say it is visually a step up from that, but only just barely. Paul Feig's not incompetent. He's a good director in some regards, but like it's also just it's like it looks like it was shot in about 2 weeks. Like everything happens very quickly. Like the lighting is all pretty flat. I don't know. It's not a good film. It's a bad movie. It is a bad movie. It is maybe entertainingly bad, but it's not even over the top enough. And this is my big problem with the film. Like I almost feel like it needs to be like 6 levels more heightened. Like I think it really needs to go there. And that's one of the things
I have
that Gone Girl
398
well.
Million reasons why you're wrong.
No, well, that doesn't. A movie being popular is not the same as a movie being good.
But what it needs. Right?
I'm sorry.
Yes,
I'm sorry. I didn't realize a Minecraft movie was the best film of the year last year. Oh, geez, we all missed it.
Best popular film. I will say the movie's waste of its hunky gardener subplot is a tragedy.
That really goes nowhere. Everything with the daughter is like totally miscalibrated in terms of like it's a red herring, but it's not really a red herring. But the stuff with the mom is, I understand what they're going for there. Yes, she passed down her craziness to her son, but it's like uninterestingly crazy. It's just stupidly crazy. Like the stuff about, I don't know. It's a bad movie. It's a bad movie. But it does. I understand its appeal. I get its charms. I like plenty of bad movies. I just didn't love this one. Anyway, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Housemaid, Peter?
It's not a great movie, but I didn't come out of it thinking I was upset that I watched that. Kind of enjoyed watching it with my wife, who was like, oh,
which is how I told you to watch it.
Oh, you're at least, in fact, Alyssa was correct. Watch this with your wife, with your spouse, with your significant other. She was like, oh, you're not a bad husband. Not that she usually said, but like, she was like, oh, it was nice. Right. So
You've
in that respect, I enjoyed it. And so for that reason alone, I'll give it a thumbs up.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up. It's the first movie in a long time where I was like, you know what? When the sequel comes out, I want to get some of my mom friends together for brunch and to see this. Because, like, trash has its place in the American pop culture ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bad movie, so thumbs down. But I do, again, I understand the appeal of its badness. I just wish it, I honestly wish it had just been worse. That's my big takeaway is, I like, this movie, the sequel should be, like, 15% more ridiculous.
Like, Amanda Seyfried, really. Amanda Seyfried had, like, we didn't talk about her at all, but she just has the power to turn a lot of just unwatchable stuff pretty watchable. She's also really good in the FX or Hulu Elizabeth Holmes miniseries. Like, I recommend.
Yeah. She definitely has, she has a vibe to her that is, she can do calculatingly crazy very well, which I appreciate. But it's just not a, it's still not a very good movie. Anyway,
I just like that the woman who wrote the novel that this was based on studied math at Harvard and then became a doctor and started writing self-published fiction after her residency was over. And like, this is like, in some sense, like, this is the product of a very high quality, right? This is trash, but it's kind of very high quality trash, and you can see the lineage there.
Is okay, sure. All right, that's it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at moviel.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. If you're Paul Feig, you can just send me an email. You know, we chat a lot. I know you listen to the show, so I apologize for slandering your work here. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.